once again to another Throttle Up radio show and podcast. I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, U.S. Navy retired, and I am glad to be here on another radio show and podcast. One of the things that I most enjoy in my week is to do this show. Okay, so couple of administrative things, sometimes called housekeeping things, that I should mention. The podcast can be found on our website, throttleupradio.com, and the Also, it could be found on iTunes and a couple of other platforms as well. Now, we do have a book. It's called Critical Thinking Essentials. Subtitle is Quick Reference Handbook. That's available in hardcover or in ebook format. Something that we mention from time to time, but I think we probably should mention it a bit more often. I think it's probably most useful given today's current situation in this country and this world. How are we to think about what is going on? Now, this book, we call it a handbook, actually, because it's more in the handbook format. This book can help you understand how you should think about things, how you should go about your thinking process. You don't engage in thinking without some kind of a thinking plan in place, particularly if you're doing something that is important, that is stressful, most importantly, if it is critical. We need to have a plan in place. We need to have some kind of a organizing structure by which we engage our thinking mechanisms in order for us to deal with the particular issue that is often serious. It could even be life-threatening. It could be also, we use the terms, a high-value situation or something that requires high performance, and so forth. And so that's where we are right now. So we are trying to deal with this situation that is occurring, that is unfolding before our eyes in this rather strange world of ours, beset with all kinds of problems and difficulties, not least of which is a global pandemic. As we all know, painfully so. There is also an economic component to it. There is also this whole issue of cyber attack or cyber warfare or things of that nature. And so we're trying to make sense out of all of this. There is a looming fairly large on the horizon human trafficking. I know there's a new movie coming out this fall called The Sound of Freedom, and there are other people sounding the alarm about human trafficking and things like that, human slavery and all kinds of disturbing things that are a direct violation on what we call human rights, not only in this country, but in this world. All right, so how are we going to think about it? Now, we began this series that we're in the middle of right now. The series is called The Truth. How do we know that something is true? Now, we've been trying to construct as a important mental exercise, we've been trying to construct what we refer to as the truth algorithm. How do we know that something that is claimed to be true is actually true? How do we know that? And you can say, okay, well, we need this kind of evidence, or we need this kind of expert to weigh in, or stuff like that. And that really misses the whole point, because then we get caught in this intellectual cul-de-sac where we don't actually know. We keep just going around and around in this circle. And we never, you know, we never break out of it. We never really discover a meaningful pathway through this process that we call inquiry and discovery. What is our mechanism? What is our pathway to discover whether or not something is true? It's often called the theory of truth. That is a term that's used. It comes from the field that is often referred to as the theory of knowledge. Comes from that term, and I guess you could say it is a subcategory of the theory of knowledge. So, is there, in fact, something that addresses this issue that we call the theory of truth? Is there a theoretical basis by which we can begin to understand if, in fact, something is true? And we talked about this from various perspectives and from various aspects. One of the more commonly used mechanisms is the correspondence theory, which is whatever is being claimed to be true, does it have a corresponding factor existing within the model of reality that we have created, that we have embraced? Is there some kind of a correspondence to something else that could bring to the process some kind of support or aid to the question by which we are seeking an answer? Another way of thinking about this is, if we are in a period of confusion, is there some kind of a mental performance aid that we can employ that would help us determine whether something is actually true? In other words, if we have some kind of a theoretical basis for the discovery of truth, is there, or can we convert that theory into some kind of a performance aid, or some kind of a guide, if you will, or some kind of a mental assistance function by which we can determine with a fairly high degree of accuracy whether this thing is actually true. And this thing could be anything. Could be an event. It could be a statement. Could be an assertion. It could be a pronouncement. You name it. It could be anything out there. It could be a new comet that we think may be heading in our direction. And there have been certain claims associated with this comet. And this comet might be on a collision course with Earth. How do we know that that is true? It's being claimed to be true, but it could not necessarily be true. So how do we know that that claim is in fact true? Something that is claimed to be true, is it actually true? How do we know that? So here we're trying to understand how to construct this truth algorithm. And one of the things that we have, we've been through, I think, four branches already. So this would be the fifth branch of the algorithm. And we have to do all of this within some kind of a context. We have to do all of this in what we call what occupies the playing field, what occupies our mind space. Let's say the playing field and the mind space are similar or analogous to one another. What are the things that occupy this space? This conceptual space. Okay, we talked about those things in the past. We talked about, okay, what's in play? What do we need to know about the overall characteristics of this particular place that we are occupying in time and space? What is going on? We talked about, okay, what's in play? Are there politics in play? Is there scientific theory in play? Is there propaganda in play? We don't have to actually believe or disbelieve in propaganda or indoctrination. We just have to understand or recognize that it is in fact in play, that is part of the mind space, part of the playing field. We talked about those kinds of things. What is actually in play? And that kind of helps us narrow down our search for the truth by understanding things that are in play. In this case, or for this week, we are narrowing our focus down a little bit further by seeing if we can understand this thing called the true versus the claimed to be true. If something is claim to be true, is it in fact true? And how do we determine that? How do we know? So here now we are getting into a branch. We're getting into a binary structure that we have a claim, okay, and that would be the leading branch, and that would split into two branches, or another way of saying that, that the claim is the trunk and it breaks into two branches. Is it true? The claim, is the claim true as it purports to be, or is it not true? And that's the point of the decision by which we are dealing with. Is this claim actually true? Now, we can put this in the context of today. We can look at it in terms of, okay, is the claim that, for example, that gun availability automatically leads to gun violence, therefore we need to restrict the availability of guns within the human population. And that is a claim. Right? How do we know that that claim is in fact true? And there's all kinds of things that we can do. But what has not been done, which I think is unfortunate, what has not been done is nobody is addressing this from a theoretical basis or in a bit more general sense from a critical thinking perspective. With respect to the claim, if we are, in fact, going to use critical thinking and higher order reasoning, then we have to stay objective. We cannot bring politics into this. We cannot bring our own pet peeves into this. We cannot bring in our own sacred cows. We have to remain objective. Is this claim objectively true? Or is this claim objectively not true? What is it that helps us determine if something is objectively true? One of the things that helps us determine that is, in fact, mathematics. Mathematics is at least supposed to be non-political. It's supposed to be non-partisan. It's supposed to be factually based. It's supposed to follow the rules and the laws of logical thinking and mathematical reasoning and all kinds of things. Mathematics looks at equations. It looks at things that are, in fact, equal to one another. That's primarily what mathematics is all about. So if we have a claim that says that such and such is true, does that actually equal the truth? Is there a linear relationship between the claim and the objective truth of the matter? And one of the things that can help us in this regard in terms of the determination of the truth, and let me put it in a little bit different context here, because we're beginning to really get down to the essence of the argument. We're getting down to the essence of the argument. And what is the argument? The argument is objectively, is this claim true or is it not true? And we can even use some threshold logic. We can say that if it is expected to be true at the 95% probability that it is, that we can say that it is actually true. It doesn't have to be 100%, doesn't have to be complete certitude for us to believe it, because the world is often messy and there's a lot of indeterminism in the world, a lot of uncertainty. We can talk about the uncertainty principle. We bring a whole bunch of things into this mind space of ours, this thought structure, as we examine this whole issue. I could see that, you know, that we would cover such a thing if we had a let's say that we were that I was giving a presentation at a theoretical major conference that dealt with the theory of truth, theory of knowledge, and the theory of truth. There's all kinds of things that I could present in PowerPoint format on a big screen and show you how we can connect things together and how mathematics can help us. In the meantime, I'll try to make this explanation a little bit more understandable. Are there things that can help us along the way in our process by which we can create this or construct this equation? The claim to be true equals the objective truth of the matter. That's the equation that we're working with. All right. And so we can begin to think of this thing in terms of the belief, in terms of a belief system, a belief structure. Now, here I want to take a little bit of a move away from the mathematical aspects of it and look at some of the human side of this discussion for a bit. And the human side of this discussion for a bit to see if I can understand, or if we can understand, the overarching mechanism here of the thought process or the thought structure, which is, are we actually concerned first and foremost about what others think, or are we only concerned about the objective qualities and the objective characteristics of the thinking process? Do we really need to know what others think, or can we stay completely objective? So let's listen to this audio clip. It does deal with this issue directly. I think it's important. Again, I use this source, which is the Academy of Ideas, which is a really good source for us, all of us, to gain some additional knowledge in this whole quest for the theory of truth.
Put up with being laughed at on occasion. Look around you, and give yourself a good shaking to find out who you really are. Common sense tells us that a modicum of concern for the opinions of others is useful in the cultivating of good relationships and the maintenance of social cohesion. But most people care too much about what other people think, and in this video, we will explore how this is damaging to our psychological health. We will then look at how becoming more comfortable with ridicule, rejection, and the disdain of others can greatly increase our chance of living a fulfilling life. "It never ceases to amaze me," wrote Marcus Aurelius. "We all love ourselves more than other people, but care more about their opinion than our own." In the modern West, a great emphasis is placed on the attainment of social validation and on looking good in the eyes of others, and this is creating a population of men and women who are stunted in their development. For social validation is derived primarily from one thing: success in the external world, or at least the appearance of it. Our job title, our material possessions, the size of our bank account, our physical looks and fashion choices, the status of the people we associate with, such are the things that bring the validation that so many crave. But this excessive orientation to the world of people, places, and things is not a healthy way to live. For as Carl Jung writes, "The man whose interests are all outside is never satisfied with what is necessary, but is perpetually hankering after something more and better which, true to his bias, he always seeks outside himself. He forgets completely that, for all his outward successes, he himself remains the same inwardly. Obviously, the outward lives of men could do with a lot more bettering and beautifying, But those things lose their meaning when the inner man does not keep pace with them. Jung was no ascetic who denied the value of worldly success. Rather, his point was that without a bettering and beautifying of the inner man, or what amounts to the state of our psyche, external success will leave us none the richer. We can surround ourselves with an opulence of material goods. We can attain the contemporary social ideal of beauty and style. Our peers can admire us, but if the inner man is neglected, misery and suffering will haunt our days. Or as Jung explains, to be satiated with the necessities of external success is no doubt an inestimable source of happiness. Yet the inner man continues to raise his claim, and this can be satisfied by no outward possessions. And the less this voice is heard in the chase after the brilliant things of this world, the more the inner man becomes a source of inexplicable misfortune and uncomprehended unhappiness in the midst of living conditions whose outcome was expected to be entirely different. The externalization of life turns to incurable suffering, because no one can understand why he should suffer from himself. That is the sickness of Western man. But if an excessive orientation to the external world and an accompanied neglect of our inner development is the sickness of the West, what is the cure? We should step off the path of conformity, as to conform means to seek social validation through the ideal of external success. And we should reorient our life so as to bring more order, harmony, and strength to our psyche. We must, in other words, live a more authentic life, a life that heeds the call of our inner man. Or as the 16th century philosopher Michel de Montaigne explains, whatever it be, whether art or nature, that has inscribed in us this condition of living by reference to others, it does us much more harm than good. We defraud ourselves out of what is actually useful to us in order to make appearances conform to common opinion. We care less about the real truth of our inner selves than about how we are known to the public. But to be one of the few who stops living by reference to others necessitates a diminished fear of ridicule, rejection, and the disapproval of others. For one who fears such things will remain a conformist, and thereby forever susceptible to the sickness of which Jung spoke. And so, in recognition that a fear is best diminished by exposure to the feared object, we can turn to the ancient philosophical practice of intentionally behaving in ways that elicit social disapproval. The Roman senator Cato, a follower of Stoic philosophy who lived in the 1st century BC, was an advocate of this practice, and as William Irvine writes in his book, A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy, one way to overcome our obsession with winning the admiration of other people is to go out of our way to do things likely to trigger their disdain. Cato made a point of ignoring the dictates of fashion. According to Plutarch, Cato did this not because he sought vainglory. To the contrary, he dressed differently in order to accustom himself to be ashamed only of what was really shameful, and to ignore men's low opinion of other things. In other words, Cato consciously did things to trigger the disdain of other people simply so he could practice ignoring their disdain. Another famous figure who engaged in this practice was Diogenes the Cynic, who lived in the 4th century BC. On an almost daily basis, Diogenes took actions that evoked ridicule, rejection, and disdain. As but one example, he would walk backward into theaters against the flow of everyone who was exiting, for the purpose of acclimating himself to acts of nonconformity. When he did this, people would mock him and question his purpose, to which he replied, "Aren't you ashamed that while you're walking in the wrong direction in life, you scoff at me for walking backwards?" Diogenes was so successful at detaching himself from any concern of what other people thought of him that he reached a level of freedom most can only dream of. The chains of other people's opinions no longer constricted him, the burden of social validation did not weigh on him, and instead of shaping his life to look good in the eyes of others, his sole purpose was to cultivate a greatness of self through mastery of body and mind. When someone said to Diogenes, "Most people laugh at you," he replied, "and doubtless donkeys laugh at them, but just as they pay no heed to the donkeys, I pay none to them." This approach to life did not result in Diogenes being looked down upon by all of his peers. Rather, many famous figures admired him. Alexander the Great was so impressed with his character that he stated, "If I were not Alexander, I would like to be Diogenes." While the great Stoic philosopher Epictetus considered Diogenes to be the rare example of a real-life sage. "But I can show you a free man," said Epictetus, "to save you from having to search any longer for an example." Diogenes was free. To move toward the ideal of a Diogenes, we may find it useful to adopt the following mindset when engaging in our practice. We are not performing acts of nonconformity merely to look like a fool, nor to attract attention or annoy people. Our purpose is to learn more about human nature and more about our own potential. We are practicing what Nietzsche called psychological observation, and so when our actions elicit ridicule or disapproval, we can follow the advice of the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, who counseled the following. If you come across any special trait of meanness or stupidity, you must be careful not to let it annoy or distress you, but to look upon it merely as an addition to your knowledge, a new fact to be considered in studying the character of humanity. Your attitude towards it will be that of the mineralogist who stumbles upon a very characteristic specimen of a mineral. Another way to ease the sting of ridicule is to remember that very often the people who are quickest to judge and the most excessive with their insults are those whose opinions matter least. They are not men and women of sound mind, but individuals consumed by the sickness of the West, who use criticism as a means to project their misery and self-hate onto others. And as Epictetus wrote, "Who are these people whose admiration you seek? Aren't they the ones you are used to describing as mad? Well, then, is that what you want? To be admired by lunatics?" This ancient philosophical practice of voluntarily exposing ourselves to ridicule and rejection will teach us an important lesson. The world does not end when someone shames us, and no harm really comes to us when others disapprove of our ways, so long as we are comfortable with the actions we take. With time, insults and negative judgments by other people will become mere empty words that may pass through our ears but do not disturb our mind. We will no longer feel compelled to live by reference to others, and if we are then willing to listen to the call of our inner man or woman, a greater life will open before us. Free of the fear of ridicule, we will be free of the sickness of Western man. The greatest height of heroism to which an individual can attain is to know how to face ridicule. Better still, to know how to make oneself ridiculous and not to shrink from the ridicule.
Okay, so here we have a good discussion of what we are to do with this whole issue of how people think about us. So are we making the objective decision here, or are we either directly or indirectly factoring into our decision-making process? And let me just restate that for clarity. The decision-making process before us is whether or not this statement or this assertion is true, or it is not true. Are we coming to that conclusion based upon our own inner logic, our own internal capabilities to engage in critical thinking, or are we concerned, are we worried about, are we paying attention to what we think others are thinking about this? So if we enter this mind space, are we counting all of those people who believe that A is A, or are we making some kind of a judgment or determination based upon the number of people who might actually believe such a thing? Or are we looking at this thing entirely objectively, not taking into account the judgment of others. How do we deal with that? Are we concerned about the disdain of others? Are we concerned about others' opinion? Are we concerned about social validation? Are we concerned about external success? And things like that. So we have to do this audit. We have to do this rather rigorous examination of the fact that are we dealing with this based upon its own internal logic, or are we considering what others might think? So that's an important concern. Now, for the next order of business, we are going to listen to this other, it's actually another related audio clip. And the audio clip is called, I'm looking for it now as we, the title of this other audio clip is How Civil Disobedience Safeguards Freedom and Prevents Tyranny. Now, here we have a case where it actually has been determined that something is fundamentally wrong. Something is seriously out of place. Something is not believable, and we have to do something. And so now we need to look at this from afar, and we have to look at this in terms of, is there in fact something going on within the human, within the group of humans that we are dealing with? Is there something else going on besides the opinion of others? Is there some kind of a social disturbance? Is that affecting this particular group of human beings? And we have to consider that as well, because as we examine the ability to disregard the thoughts of others, we also have to examine, are some of these concerns being expressed openly by certain groups of people? For example, if it has been asserted that access to guns, unconstrained access to guns, directly increases gun violence in a society, and there are groups that are opposing the confiscation of guns, we need to consider that as well, because that is part of the process by which we either embrace or consider that as part of our decision-making process here, or is this another case, another example by which we have to exclude this from the objective analysis, this mathematically oriented discovery of whether or not something is true? So let's listen to this.
Monsters exist, but they are far too few in number to be truly dangerous. The most dangerous monsters are ordinary men and women, ready to believe and obey without asking questions. Is a peaceful and prosperous society dependent on strict obedience to the laws and dictates of the state? Is voting the only proper means to show displeasure with the commands of politicians and bureaucrats, while school systems and the mainstream media try to indoctrinate us with an obedient mindset And while politicians desire an almost blind obedience from the populace, history tells a different story about the value of always doing what we are told. In this video, we are going to discuss why obedience, not disobedience, is the greatest threat to mankind, while also examining how civil disobedience keeps the society free. "The problem," wrote the American historian Howard Zinn, "is not a disobedience, it is obedience. The real question," echoes the psychologist Wilhelm Reich, "is not to know why people rebel, but why they don't rebel." While the Grimke sisters, famous for their work with the abolitionist and women's suffrage movements of the 19th century, put it this way: "The doctrine of blind obedience and unqualified submission to any human power, whether civil or ecclesiastical, is the doctrine of despotism." In the 20th century, as millions upon millions of bodies piled up in socialist and fascist countries, it became evident to all those who cared to look that obedience can kill. In the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, Cambodia, China, and North Korea, it was not rebellion or a disregard for law that sent hundreds of millions to an early death, but the fact that in such countries people obeyed too much. They obeyed laws that were immoral, and they accepted commands from politicians and bureaucrats that were socially destructive. The horrific experiences in these countries taught us a very important lesson, but one that has quickly been forgotten. Sometimes it is obedience, not a disobedience, that is the true crime. Or as Peter Ustinov wrote in a 1967 article in The New Yorker, "For centuries, men were punished for having disobeyed. At the Nazi trials of Nuremberg, for the first time, men were punished for having obeyed. The repercussions of this precedent are only now beginning to make themselves felt." But even if laws that lead to the suffering of innocent people and to the destruction of a society should be disobeyed, this proves very difficult after a country has descended into full-blown totalitarianism. For with totalitarianism comes an enslavement of the population. First, an enslavement of the minds of the masses through incessant propaganda, and then a physical enslavement through mass surveillance, police forces, and a judicial system whose main job is to keep people in a state of submission. Under these oppressive conditions of the all-powerful centralized state, disobedience takes a heroic act of the will, as stepping out of line can easily be paid for with one's life. What makes disobedience even more challenging under totalitarianism is that when the state controls all, economic activity grinds to a halt. This leads to shortages in life's necessities, and when one is hungry, finding food, not resisting tyranny, is front of mind. Or as Theodore Dalrymple explains, "In totalitarianism, shortages of material goods, even of necessities, were not a drawback but a great advantage for the rulers. These shortages were not accidental to the terror, but one of its most powerful instruments. Not only did shortages keep people's minds strictly on bread and sausage, and divert their energies to procuring them so that there was no time or inclination left over for subversion, but the shortages meant that people could be brought to inform, spy, and betray each other very cheaply." Disobedience, therefore, is not an antidote to full-blown tyranny. Disobedience, rather, is a preventative measure to tyranny. But to be effective at returning freedom to a society at risk of losing it, disobedience must endure widespread support. It must, in other words, take the form of civil disobedience. When an individual practices disobedience in a solitary manner, this is referred to as dissidence or conscientious objection. Civil disobedience, on the other hand, occurs when a group of people disobey and in a public manner. This act of mass noncompliance sends a message that no politician wants to hear. The people no longer fear them, no longer respect them, and will no longer obey them. The current form of governance has been deemed no longer acceptable, and in contrast to a protest whereby a populace asks for its freedom back, with civil disobedience, a populace begins to take its freedom back. Or as Murray Rothbard explains, "Mass nonviolent resistance as a method for the overthrow of tyranny stems directly from the fact that all rule rests on the consent of the subject masses. For if tyranny rests on mass consent, then the obvious means for its overthrow is simply by mass withdrawal of that consent. the weight of tyranny would quickly and suddenly collapse under such a non-violent revolution. But how can enough people be awakened to the necessity of disobeying laws that are socially destructive? What, in other words, leads to a movement of civil disobedience that can defeat tyranny? One possible tactic is to use reason, logic, and argumentation to make the masses aware of the deceptions, lies, and manipulations which are being used to herd them into totalitarianism. This approach is based on the notion that if the truth were presented and the propaganda deconstructed, most people would rise up in defiance and cast off their chains. But an appeal to reason and evidence only works on minds that are open and receptive, and when tyranny is rising, ever fewer minds exist in this state. Rather, fear, confusion, anger, and uncertainty run rampant, and these emotions can easily trump the power of reason. The mass crushes out the insight and reflection that are still possible within the individual, writes Carl Jung. Rational argument can be conducted with some prospect of success only so long as the emotionality of a given situation does not exceed a certain critical degree. If the affective temperature rises above this level, the possibility of reasons having any effect ceases, and its place is taken by slogans and chimerical wish fantasies. That is to say, a sort of collective possession results, which rapidly develops into a psychic epidemic. This observation that a people can become immune to logic and reason was shared by the writer Elie Wiesel, who upon visiting the Soviet Union wrote, "Logic will not help you here. You have your logic, they have theirs, and the distance between you two cannot be bridged by words." What is needed more than words and arguments are individual dissidents who act as the motivating examples for the larger movements of civil disobedience. For the power of example always reigns supreme in its ability to influence others. When people see that someone is willing to take risks in defense of their beliefs, and that their words are congruent with their actions, this lends more credence to their position. And while the example of a dissident may not awaken those most blind to the chains of control that are being placed around them, it can exert a strong influence on the many who are on the fence as to what to think and how to act. But without an intrepid few willing to be the example for others, a sort of prisoner's dilemma exists. No one is willing to be the first to disobey, and so everyone sits idly by, hoping that others will save society for them. "So many others are better qualified, more competent, and effective than me," writes Frederick Gross. "A throng of good-willed souls is projected onto the horizon, ready to rise, so that I can retreat more easily. Another will act instead of me, and so much the better." But the question that a potential first mover faces is, when is it right to disobey? For while it is relatively easy to disobey when a movement of civil disobedience has gained momentum, the initial dissenters face a challenging predicament. Is disobedience worth the risk? Has the act of obedience reached such immoral proportions that to be compliant is to be complicit in the destruction of society and in the harming of innocent life? Each person must answer these questions for themselves, but an answer usually comes from within, as a command from conscience. The etymology of the word conscience tells us that it is a special form of knowledge, writes Jung. The peculiarity of conscience is that it is a knowledge of, or certainty about, the emotional value of the ideas we have concerning the motives of our actions. Conscience is a felt state. It is an intuitive form of knowledge about the rightness or wrongness of an action. One of history's most famous examples of an individual who relied on his conscience to direct him in acts of disobedience is Socrates. Socrates was commanded by the 30 tyrants to arrest an innocent man and to bring him to his death. Socrates, however, did not practice blind obedience, even if the commands came from tyrants who held the power of life and death over him. Socrates, instead, listened to his conscience. "The 30 sent for me," says Socrates, "and ordered me to bring Leon the Salaminian to be put to death. I, however, showed again, by action, not in word only, that I did not care a whit for death, but that I did care with all my might not to do anything unjust or unholy. For that government, with all its power, did not frighten me into doing anything unjust. I simply went home." In going about our day-to-day life, our conscience tends to speak quietly, and often the messages it sends are ambiguous. But this can be used to one's advantage when making the decision as to whether disobedience has now become the right choice. For as Jung points out, while many of life's moral dilemmas only elicit a whisper from our conscience, there are times when our conscience speaks so loudly and clearly that it almost seems to be the voice of a god, or as Jung writes in Civilization in Transition. Since olden times, conscience has been understood by many people less as a psychic function than as a divine intervention. Indeed, its dictates were regarded as the voice of God. This view shows what value and significance were, and still are, attached to the phenomenon of conscience. Conscience commands the individual to obey his inner voice, even at the risk of going astray. If our conscience commands us to stop obeying unjust laws, and if each time we do obey we experience feelings of loathing and guilt, then we face a difficult choice. We either obey our conscience and become a dissident, or we continue to obey the commands of tyrants, and we become a traitor to ourself. The men and women whose inner voice speaks loudest in the face of a rising tyranny are those most likely to step forward as dissidents, and it is when a common vibration of conscience rings out through a society that civil disobedience becomes possible. First, the call of conscience is answered by a relative few, but these few serve as the example for others. Whether enough people will follow to create a movement of civil disobedience is contingent on how much a populace still desires freedom, compared to what degree the populace has been psychologically subdued by the fear, hate, and confusion that is sown by the propaganda of tyrants. If, however, tyranny comes knocking in the society in which we live, and if our conscience then issues the command that we stop being complicit in the crime of obedience, we should keep in mind the following comment by Henry David Thoreau. Disobedience is the true foundation of liberty. The obedient must be slaves.
Okay, so here we have this idea that is being expressed is the acquisition of this other aspect of being human. And what is that other aspect? Now, we are not robots, and we are not calculation machines or computers. This other idea that we need to bring into the process here is the idea of a conscience. What is it that helps us as humans to make or to do the right thing? If we are trying to determine if this assertion, this proposition, this thing is true or is it not true, we also need to access our, I call it the higher order reasoning, but our higher level of consciousness. The higher level of consciousness does, in fact, represent what is often called our conscience. What is it informing us? Is it, in fact, activated? Is it informing us of something that we need to pay attention to? Okay, I can see that we are now getting to the end of our show, and thank you for being here, and we will see you all next week.